listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome, everybody. This is the Tom Hartman Program, obviously. I'm not Tom Hartman. We couldn't get into the studio yesterday, so...
Thank you so much for dealing with the best of yesterday, but we did make it in today. And as a result of the storm that kept us out of the studio yesterday, Mike Papantonio, who is going to be here today, his flight was canceled.
Right.
He is in the air right now.
Exactly. So you are stuck with me, Danielle, and Shano. But thankfully, we have a lot of brilliant guests to bring all that intelligent talk that you're used to hearing from Tom and Pap. Starting off, there's so much news going on, but over the weekend, a huge protest at the White House about Keystone XL. About 400 people were arrested. Apparently, 1,000 people signed up to take part in this protest against Keystone XL because they know the truth about the pipeline. And another fine gentleman joining us now does as well. Dave Saldana, the producer and director of Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed, an amazing new documentary you can check out at pipeliesexposed.org. Dave, you were at this protest over the weekend. What happened and what did you see there?
I was there for a good part of it. There were about 1,000 people, maybe a little bit more, who marched from Georgetown onto the Secretary of State's residence and then onto the White House, where probably around 400 of them either zip-tied themselves to the fence or had a die-in right in front of the White House. Happily, the police were appeared to be very respectful and sort of went along with the program, and there were no untoward moments, but around 400 people were arrested.
Wow. It just shows how much the opposition to the Keystone Pipeline is building, because there's so much misinformation. I've noticed, especially recently, we have been bombarded with TV, radio, print ads saying how great the Keystone Pipeline is going to be for our country. You would disagree with that. Is that safe to say?
I would very strongly disagree with that. Some of your listeners might know that I was on Tom's television show last week talking about some of the lies. There's no polite way to put it. They're just lies that TransCanada and the American Petroleum Institute and their friends on Capitol Hill have been repeating now for going on 5 years around things like jobs and pipeline safety and tax revenues and what have you. And they're quite simply false. And they have been proven wrong time and time again, but those numbers are repeated and those claims are repeated over and over again. And they simply have no factual basis.
Is that what prompted you to make this documentary, the Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed documentary, just to get the real information out there?
Yeah, I was speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the executive director of Center for Media and Democracy, who executive produced this this mini doc. It's about 23 minutes long. I would strongly urge your listeners and viewers to take a look at it. And she's a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. And we were talking about how bad this project appears to be, but how much conflicting information there is and how so many claims and counterclaims dancing back and forth. So we decided as lawyers to look at the evidence. You know, there's a saying in law, you can say whatever you want, but what can you prove?
Yeah.
And we decided to look at the evidence and see what could be proved. And what we turned up was that every word that came from TransCanada and the API, including of and the, was false.
Lies from the oil industry. I am so shocked.
Right.
What about the projections for jobs? That's, I think, one of the biggest talking points we're hearing lately is that this is going to be a huge boost for jobs and a huge boost for our economy. And you looked at this information, including the assessment from the State Department. What do you say to those claims?
Wrong. Just false. We heard numbers ranging from 20,000, 10,000, 120,000. And those numbers uniformly came from the pipeline companies or the oil companies or the API. When put to the test, when put under a microscope, for instance, the Cornell University's Global Labor Institute took a look at The 120,000 jobs claim that came from a study sponsored by TransCanada, the company that's trying to build the pipeline. And they found that it was, quote, unsubstantiated. Those numbers were, quote, unsubstantiated, which is a very polite way of saying they made it up.
Yeah.
There was no factual basis for it.
I just want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Dave Saldana, the producer and director of Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed. You can check it out at pipeliesexposed.org. And once again, obviously, I'm not Tom Hartman. There's also been this discussion going on about Keystone, and every single point that people start talking about it is that the tar sands oil is automatically going to be mined, that it's automatically, it's definitely going to be transported throughout our country, and that everything is kind of how to deal with the situation thereafter. Why do we have to start the discussion there, and why can't we just say no to this type of toxic oil in our country?
Short answer, we don't and we can. The market is glutted now. The U.S. is exporting oil at this point. Demand in the U.S. is down. That's for a lot of reasons, first of which the economic recovery is not trickled down to workaday folks who might spend more money on gasoline for traveling and what have you. But it's also because the U.S. is simply producing more oil than we need at this point. So we don't need more oil. We've got more than we can use at this point. What TransCanada and the oil producers in Alberta want is to get that oil into a global market because they're taking about a 30% hit on the price of their oil. In the open market, it might get about $100 a barrel. Right now, it's only getting about $70 a barrel because it's going to Midwestern refineries, and that market is glutted. So in order to get that $100 per barrel, and this isn't me talking, this is the energy minister of the government of Alberta. It's the energy minister of the Canadian federal government who are saying things like, we need to get this money to this oil to Asia, right? It's not about us. It's not about U.S. energy security. It's about getting Canadian oil to Chinese factories. The upshot of all of this is we don't need it, and there's no reason to assume that it's going to be produced with or without access to U.S. refineries, because they're presently producing somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 barrels a day going through existing pipelines. What Keystone XL would do is triple that till they're putting out about 1 million barrels a day.
Wow.
So that's not something that we need. That's not something that this market needs at all. Not when we have access to increasing renewables and using fewer fossil fuels. It's not something that we need to be investing in. That's something that a lot of people really don't think about is, you know, this all of the above energy policy that they talk about in, as in, you know, we'll use oil now while we're working on doing better solar, better wind. Well, TransCanada is talking about investing billions of dollars to build this pipeline. Do you think they're going to give that up in a couple of years? No,
right.
That infrastructure is being built to last as long as they can possibly squeeze nickel out of it.
Exactly. Now, there's a public comment period that ends March 7th, so people can go over to the State Department and add their name, add their comment, and their opinion about Keystone. After they do that, and after they check out this amazing documentary, what should they do next to put their foot down on Keystone?
Share it. Spread the word. Tell as many people as possible. Our documentary is available online. Invite people over. Share it on Facebook, on Twitter, on what have you. Talk about it. There are some folks who've approached us about having house parties where they can invite their neighbors. Always a brilliant idea.
It's really amazing, amazing work you're doing. The documentary, again, is Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed. You can check it out at pipeliesexposed.org. Dave, thanks so much for joining us and for coming in today.
Not a problem, Danielle. Glad to be here.
We will be back with more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We just heard about a future oil disaster. We're going to talk about a previous one next with Farron Cousins. Stick around. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Once again, obviously, I am not Tom Hartman. He is away, and he will be back soon.
And you are Danielle.
Yes.
You should probably put that in the more positive. Yes.
Yes. And we were just speaking with Dave Saldana about Keystone, the possibility for a huge future and present oil disaster. And so we wanted to speak with Farron Cousins, the executive editor of the Trial Lawyer magazine and a contributing writer for DSmog blog, about a past oil disaster and the fact that we're still dealing with it. Farron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Danielle, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, we are thrilled to have you, and thanks for all of that great booking for PAP that worked out really well for Shane and I.
Very glad.
You just wrote a great piece over on Alternate, a little frustrating, but a great write-up of reminders of the BP oil spill. Apparently, people going to celebrate Mardi Gras got a little bit more than they bargained for. Is that correct?
They did. You know, we're Mardi Gras is very big in the South here, and expecting probably about a million people from last week until all the way up to today, really. And then last Thursday, right here in our hometown of Pensacola, we had a 1,200 to 1,300-pound tar mat wash up on the beach. And all the tests that they've conducted on it confirm that it is, in fact, from the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster.
Now,
go ahead.
Now, we've heard from BP and all of those lovely, fancy, expensive ads that all the oil has been cleaned up. A 1,200-pound tar mat, how could they miss that, and how could they claim that everything is all better in the Gulf?
Well, they missed it, and they can make that claim because they've stopped looking. Last summer, you know, BP pulled their cleanup crews completely away from the Gulf Coast. They said, we're done. A few weeks later, the U.S. Coast Guard did the same thing. So it's easy for something of that size to go unnoticed when you're not looking for it. You know, this thing wasn't evident until it was washing up in the waves. And that's what we're dealing with down here. And it's happening all along the Gulf Coast. This is not the first one that's popped up in recent months. A couple months ago in Perdido Key, right between Alabama-Florida line, another tar mat. Not quite as big, but big enough to be called a tar mat instead of a tar ball, washed up there. So, I mean, this is happening all over the Gulf Coast. And they're not out there cleaning. They're not out there looking. And it's something that's going to continue to happen here. And, you know, BP has spent $57 million. They've given $57 million to the Gulf Coast states down here in order to promote tourism. And a lot of that actually did go to promote the Mardi Gras festivities. So it's very ironic timing for BP that as soon as we get these hundreds of thousands of visitors down here, they're slapped in the face with a reminder of what BP has done to this area.
Now, if we're finding huge tar mats, 1,200, 1,300 pounds, what do you suppose we're not finding, we're not seeing, about how much oil there really still is in the Gulf?
Oh, God, you can only imagine. And one of the biggest claims that they made was that, okay, well, not everything's been cleaned up, but don't worry about it. It's just gonna dissolve in the water and it's gone. Well, when something dissolves, it doesn't go away. It's like putting sugar in your coffee. Yes, it dissolves, but you still taste it. It's still there. And so now we're getting all these, you know, wildlife examples of where this oil has gone, the stuff that's allegedly dissolved. We have dolphins over in Louisiana that are coming up with mysterious, you know, lung diseases and dying, washing up on the beaches. We have tuna, you know, coming down in South Florida where oil wasn't even washing up, but the effects have already reached down there too. Tuna coming up with the heart attacks directly related to this oil. And, you know, the shrimp are dying. They're being born without eyes. They have weird tumors. The same thing with the crabs and all of the bottom feeders who live where all of that oil has now settled. It hasn't dissolved. It might not be washing up just yet, but it's sitting on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico right now.
Yet with all of the effects that we're seeing with sea life, shrimp, fish, crabs, dolphins and tuna, as you just mentioned, how is it that they say there have been no injuries, no sicknesses, illnesses to humans, despite a lot of claims to the contrary?
Well, you know, the cleanup crews all along the coast began reporting these mystery respiratory illnesses that are still only classified as mystery respiratory illnesses. My wife was pregnant during the entire spill. We live not far from the coast. My daughter was born with very, very severe asthma. A couple weeks ago, she was in the hospital for a full week. And that's not common. There's not much history of asthma in my family, and certainly not to that extent. And while you can't necessarily say that it is attributed, I've spoken with a couple doctors, and they are seeing a significant rise in respiratory illnesses all along the Gulf Coast for people who were breathing in those fumes for months at a time. There's no way that does not have an effect on people.
So if BP's not looking for these oil mats, tar mats anymore, and people are still dealing with the effects, tourism is still being affected, how do we get them to take responsibility? Is it possible that we can still hold them accountable for the health effects, for the effects on our environment, and for things like 1,200-pound tar mats washing up on our shores?
Well, one of the best ways are these lawsuits coming against BP. In fact, yesterday, a fantastic ruling out of the courts in Louisiana, BP had sued to try to halt the claims process because they claimed it was just riddled with fraud. This is when they were launching their massive ad blitz, taking out full-page ads in the Washington Post, saying, this is not the settlement we agreed to. And a few weeks ago, the judge had ruled, okay, we will halt the process and look into these claims of fraud. And turns out, nope, no fraud, BP, you're still going to pay. And that ruling came down yesterday afternoon.
Wow.
Which is great. So, I mean, they're still fighting it. They're going to continue to fight it, but they're not going to get away with it.
Farron, thank you. Amazing reporting, as always, and it's always great to talk to you. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
Farron Cousins, everybody, the executive editor of the Trial Lawyer magazine and contributing writer for D Smog Blog. We will be back with lots more here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Rick Scott, Scott Walker, who do you think is the worst governor? John Nichols is going to tell us next. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I am Danielle, and Shano is here with me. We are doing our best to fill in for Tom.
Tom, who sent us a picture from a very sunny beach.
Yes, as in the middle of
our snowstorm.
Yes. Many of us around the country are dealing with some interesting governors. Governors blocking Medicaid expansions, attacking voting rights, waging a war on women's reproductive rights. The list goes on and on. So we have a lot of questions when it comes to who the worst governor is. And John Nichols of The Nation says that, in fact, it is Governor Paul LePage of Maine. John, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it.
I'm honored to be with you, and I don't think you're just making do. You sound just fine.
Thank you very much. So why is LePage the worst governor of all? I mean, that's a pretty steep list to climb to the top of.
It sure is, and I'm a little careful here. I you know, as any headline writer does, there's a little qualification there.
Of course.
But and also the realization that it's a competition, so anybody could pull ahead, you know, in the next week. But Paul LePage really does stand out. And I say this as somebody, I think many listeners to this show know, who's spent an immense amount of time calling out Scott Walker in Wisconsin.
As is necessary.
Very necessary. And griping about his activities, gone to Ohio to call out John Kasich and the things he's done there, spent a lot of time looking at Governor Corbett in Pennsylvania, who, you know, you could devote whole shows to. and the list goes on. But
yes.
Here's Paul LePage is pretty interesting, and I think that he has done something that merits at least a consideration for the title of worst. And that is, last week, if we had a media in this country that actually covered what happens in the states rather than being totally Washington-focused, people would know. LePage got called out in a profound way. The U.S. Department of Labor was asked to come into Maine to examine whether Paul LePage had told the people who make decisions about unemployment claims to bias their decisions against the jobless.
Now, as stunning as this sounds, I'm curious, a Republican governor standing on the side of business. It doesn't sound like anything people would be so surprised of, but what was it about the way he did this that actually makes it so shocking?
Well, he called the hearing examiners. Yeah, I mean, Republican governors standing up saying, yeah, business should be able to do whatever it wants to do, basically clearing all the barriers out for it. That's so common, it wouldn't even merit a discussion, right? But what LePage did was he called the hearing examiners, the people who weigh unemployment claims. If you get laid off from a mill or a factory or a store, and you know, you've got some sort of question of, you know, you're on your benefits, how long they'll be, what you'll get, things of that nature. If you're not being treated fairly by your employer who's laid you off or in some other way left you jobless, he called them all to his residence and said to him, look, you know, we just have to be more generous to business. You know, you can't, by all accounts from people that were there, you can't, you know, take the side of these workers. You got to really, you know, put a lot more benefit on for the businesses. And the interesting thing about it is that that's meddling at a level that is, it goes much deeper than what we usually talk about. Because remember, when somebody's jobless, when they've lost their job, they're at one of the most vulnerable points in their life. And we have structures in this country to help them. Now, I'm not talking about extending unemployment benefits. I'm talking about the basic benefits here. And those benefits are governed in many levels by U.S. labor law. In fact, the U.S. Department of Labor oversees and has a lot of role in how these benefits are decided, in how these operations work in the states. And LePage intervened in such an aggressive way that the Department of Labor came in and investigated. LePage denied that the investigation was going on, but they finally produced their report last week, and the report was devastating. Every newspaper in Maine had front-page headlines about how this guy was actually biasing the process, trying to bias the process against jobless people in Maine. And it's shaken the state to such an extent. Maine's a very working-class state, that there have been calls for his impeachment. More than 20,000 people, roughly 20,000 people, have almost instantaneously signed petitions calling for him to resign. There is just a huge outcry there, and it's a very healthy thing. This is how people should respond. We should not be casual about someone who uses the power of government against the most vulnerable. And I will add, just for icing on the cake here, that this is just the latest Paul LePage.
Right.
This is a guy, I mean, the list on this guy is endless.
Yes.
His language is often vile and hugely objectionable. He has said and done things that have raised questions about his sensitivity on race, gender, sexuality, labor rights. I mean, you run down the list. So this is just the latest thing. But it is, to my mind, a huge abuse of political power.
You know, this meddling in established processes that protect people like workers, like women, like children who are protected by labor laws, it seems to be spreading throughout the Republican governors. As you mentioned, Corbett and Rick Scott, Scott Walker, John Kasich, of course, you know, plenty of coverage of Chris Christie. Is this cronyism and putting lobbyists and businesses ahead of voters, is that like a new requirement to get elected in the GOP, or is this really the end result of just way too much money in politics?
Well, I think you ask a really good question. And remember, again, you know, we're focusing on LePage today. Tomorrow we could do, or the next day we could do Walker.
Yes.
Then we go. So, I mean, we should really be cautious about presuming, you know, on any given day one of them is worse than another. But here, I think you asked the exact right question when you pull this together. And here's an interesting way to understand this. Not long ago, a national group did a survey of the worst governors in the country. And this is CREW, the Washington Ethics and Government Group. And they actually looked at Democrats and Republicans. They found Democrats that did bad stuff, Republicans. This is not some sort of big bias on one side or the other, partisan-wise. But what they did come back to again and again and again was the use of the power of a governmental office, an office you have obtained temporarily through an election, to shift the whole dynamic, not politically, but economically and socially in your state. And many of these governors, the worst abusers of these offices, have essentially determined that we are now in a winner-take-all politics. Like, you get the governorship, you do what you want. Get rid of labor law like Scott Walker did, really undermine collective bargaining. Go after, you know, women's right to choose. Go after all the structural supports for education. All of these assaults. And you ask, well, why would a governor feel so both empowered and also determined to take those actions? And I think you got to the heart of it. This has very little to do with a political party. This has a lot to do with money.
Mm-hmm.
And money in politics. You know, when you run for governor now, you're not, you know, going out and, you know, knocking on doors and stopping at the corner to talk to somebody about issues. You are running a multi-million-dollar, $20, $30, $40 million corporate, and I'll use the term corporate in the small C term, operation. And you have immense amounts of money flowing in. You're getting all sorts of supports from national players. And for us to assume that that comes without strings attached, for us to assume that once you've achieved that power, there are not expectations on you, is the worst sort of naivete. So,
yep.
Yes, I think the money issue is huge.
I certainly do as well. How, in the minute or so we have left, how do we convince people to stop voting for politicians like this? It may be a big fight to get money out of politics. In the meantime, how do we convince voters to just stop picking cronyists and crooks?
Well, right off the bat, we're talking about it on a radio show, and that's a pretty important thing. Using the existing media that we have to expose, to challenge, being aghast at things. I think one of the most important things for us to do is to kind of re-energize or renew our ability to be angry, to be horrified, to be shocked. And that's one of the reasons I've focused on LePage in the last week or so, because I think we should be aghast. I think we should be shocked that a governor has been called out for using the power of his office, you know, all of this great power of government, to undermine the circumstance of people who have lost their jobs.
Yeah. You know, it is hard to get shocked these days. We joke about it, but talking about governors like, you know, Kasich and Walker and Rick Scott and this parade of horribles, it's hard to get shocked. But I think you're right, and I think we do need to remember that these are officials that work for us and that we have the right to hold them accountable. John Nichols, your coverage of this, as usual, is amazing, and it's an honor to speak with you. I really, really appreciate you joining us today.
It's an honor to be with you.
Thanks so much. John Nichols, the Washington correspondent of The Nation magazine, thenation.com, and Nichols Uprising on Twitter. Check it out. We have more in store here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Who do you think could be the worst Republican governor of all, or the worst Democratic governor? Give us a call. Let us know. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I am Danielle, here with Shano. We are doing our best to fill in for Tom today, and
it's fun.
It is.
I have to say, it is a lot of fun.
It is. A little quick background. We also do a radio show called Talking Left here in D.C. You can check it out at talkingleft.com.
On the weekends.
On the weekends. Sunday mornings.
Yes. We're opposite the David Gregorys of the world.
Yes, exactly.
Just fine by me.
Yes. We were just talking with John Nichols about Governor Paul LePage and, you know, whether or not he is the worst governor. As I said, Shane, parade of horribles. We have some pretty bad governors right now.
And the thing is John was talking about, you know, we need to become aghast at this. And in a different time, in a different era where this wasn't so commonplace, we would be aghast at each and every one of these. But it's kind of like putting your belt on in the morning if it's a little bit tight. You know, you feel it right at first, but as you go on with your day, you don't feel it. And you have to tighten it a little bit more if you're going to feel it. As all of these things occur, we become almost numb to them.
Yeah.
That it has to be that much worse in order to be aghast because the criminality, or at least the lack of ethics, in some case criminality, the lack of ethics is such the norm now.
Well, and I think to some degree this is like the push to the right, where we have gotten used to more and more extreme policies becoming acceptable. At least we, as in a vast majority of people, maybe not everyone listening to this show. But
if you look at the Supreme Court,
right?
Yeah, John Paul Stevens, when he left, he was considered a very liberal justice, and he said, you know, he wasn't a liberal justice when he started. And someone asked him when he became so liberal. He says, "I didn't become more liberal. The Supreme Court became more conservative. They all moved to the right of him." Yeah. That there's this general shift in politics.
There certainly is, and we want to know what you think. Is this just the result of money in politics, or is there something more at play here? Is it because of these right-wing extreme policies? You know, what's your thoughts? Give us a call, 987-866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. And we're going to check in here with Dave from Arcata, California, listening to KTLE. Dave, what do you think? Is this just money in politics?
Well, I'm glad you changed me a little, because I didn't feel qualified to rank the governors. I think that for the most part, they're all a part of a problem that's quite pervasive, and that is that if you want to be a corrupt big special interest, you pay off the Democratic Party and you pay off the Republican Party, and they will then turn and look the other way, and they stuff the money in their pockets. And this has become a very pervasive thing. I've observed it very directly. I think our friend Mr. Snowden has hit it right on. He sees accurately that those who do try to expose this kind of corruption can expect to have monitors all over their site, their email, their chat rooms, wherever we go.
Well, Dave, I certainly think that to some degree there is, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And regardless of which party we're talking about, we need to get the money out of politics.
But it's a good point. When you do bring it up, you have also those very powerful forces that are there to silence you.
Yeah.
That it takes the big voices out there. You know, you have local reporters who reported on the Chris Christie thing for a very long time until it was picked up nationally, you know.
Well, spoke with Farron Cousins earlier. Not too long ago, he did a great write-up about how the oil industry was, in fact, going into online chat rooms, to online forums, and trying to silence people who wanted to dispel the myths about climate change. We have some more calls here. Bob from We Act Radio, WPWC in Sterling, Virginia. Bob, what do you think? Is it just the money in politics that has given us our current situation?
Well, I've been following Chris Hedges very closely, and if you followed his thesis, I mean, he points to the death of the liberal class, which has been started, I guess, back in the World War II or World War I, where Wilson began, crushing protesters against World War I, and it's carried through, I guess, after the people that support, you know, the death of the Hun, and then we were directed to hate the Reds, and, it's been a long, slow process until now. We really don't have any forms of protest. There's nobody pushing the liberal class to fight back.
Don't you think that the liberals are fighting back? I mean, just this weekend, we saw 1,000 people show up at the White House to stand against Keystone XL, and 400 people were willing to get arrested to show their beliefs. Granted, the size of Keystone and the impact, that should be thousands. But I don't think it does us or our politics any service to discount the fact that 400 people were willing to stand up for what they believed in.
Oh, right. I mean, I was one of the 1,200 that got arrested with 350.org, and I was just
awesome.
Out in L.A. with the March for the Climate, which is marching all the way across the U.S. I mean, it's going to be protest politics. It's going to be you can't expect the liberals. Obama is he's if you're waiting for Obama to make any sort of a a move for the liberals in a liberal direction. I mean, he's basically, rubber stamped everything that Bush is.
Yeah, I mean, he has stood on the side of corporations quite a bit too often. I think we are well aware of that. And I think that everybody who fills in on this show speaks out against it as well as Tom. Bob, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. This is a big problem, you know, how we take back our political process and how we stop accepting politicians that are willing to be corrupt. It's a big deal. And one of the issues we're facing right now regarding this is minimum wage. We're seeing big business standing opposed to
and we're seeing thousands out on the streets too.
Right.
So
it's another big fight. We're going to speak with Tim Dickinson, the contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine, about that fight coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Just a reminder, I'm Danielle, and me and Shano are here filling in for Tom today. He will be back. Has lots of stuff to talk to you guys about.
I'm surprised he isn't calling in right now saying, put me on the air, put me on the air.
Me too. One of the points Tom constantly talks about, in fact, recently wrote Crash of 2016, is our economy and the fact that it is fundamentally broken. Inequality is a huge problem right now. Most of the income gains go straight to the top 1%, and yet we are still fighting to pay people above poverty wages. Tim Dickinson, the contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine, is joining us now. He just wrote a great piece in Rolling Stone called Hey Washington, the Pay is Too Damn Low, the Minimum Wage War. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be with you.
Now, you say that it is time to start pushing for a minimum wage hike. We've been seeing a little bit of that lately, especially from the Democratic Party. Have they finally realized that this is a winning issue both politically and economically, or is it just that inequality has gotten so bad?
Well, you know, I think Democrats are can read a poll just about as well as anybody, and there's somebody who's got 70% support, you know, and the minimum wage has lost something like 12% of its value since it was last hiked in 2007. It's a pretty obvious marker. I mean, you've got, you know, 95% of income gains since the crash, going to the top 1% of earners. You know, there's 8 million new jobs, but 2/3 of those are low wage positions. So these aren't, you know, it's no longer just a bunch of zitty teenagers flipping burgers who are working at minimum wage jobs. It's, you know, real important income earners and their families. And so this is a clear social justice issue that is in the Democratic wheelhouse. And it's also something that unites independents and Democrats as well as sort of right-minded conservative Republicans who would like to see, workers being less dependent on things like food stamps and earned income tax credit and Medicaid, and force employers to pay a higher, you know, just actual livable, if not living, wages.
Yeah.
So the politics of this set up very, very nicely for the Democrats. But the policy is just, I didn't really understand it with full appreciation until I started looking into it, sort of what an elegant policy the minimum, you know, a higher minimum wage creates. Because there's sort of this intuitive sense that, oh, if we increase the cost of employing workers, well, there'll just be less employment overall. And that's sort of an econ 101 standard model. You know, there's something intuitive to that. But as it turned out, it's a lot more complicated than that. And when you raise wages and sort of force everyone to do it in step, there are a lot of positive feedbacks that include less absenteeism, less turnover in these jobs, investments in training create a lot better return because these jobs are turning over all the time. And so you don't end up killing jobs as much as you end up killing job vacancies.
Right.
And plus, you give people a lot more money to spend, folks who are spending every marginal dollar that they earn, so the money turns right around and ends up, you know, at places like Walmart and McDonald's and the corporations who are, you know, being asked to do the right thing here. So it's not, there are many who argue that it is in fact a free lunch, that there is essentially no negative impact on employment from doing this. There are others who argue that there's a small impact. But in terms of a policy where, you know, if you take the CBO's estimate, they say it might slow job growth by about 500,000 jobs going forward. But the net impact would be to lift 1 million people out of poverty immediately and boost the paychecks of about 33 million other people.
Well, and you mentioned the CBO report, the Congressional Budget Office report. That report actually, you know, states that the likely impact could be very minimal job loss up to 1 million. So people are just rounding out and kind of speaking about this 500,000 jobs lost as if it's a definite figure. As you just mentioned, there's a lot of people who refute that claim and say that it wouldn't lead to job loss for the reason you just mentioned, is that these people spend all the money that they earn and an increase to them would stimulate our economy. How do we sort through all of that information and know what to believe and know whether job losses are worth it?
Well, so certainly, even if you take, I mean, there's almost no policy that you can make that doesn't have some sort of trade-off. So even if you take the CBO's midline estimate as gospel, that's a pretty good trade-off, you know, in terms of something that doesn't create a new government program, and it doesn't, you know, it requires very little except that people start paying you know, vaguely livable wages, and the job losses are very, you know, it's a third of 1% is what we're talking about here, and it's not a number to scoff at if it truly is 500,000, but let's not forget that the sequester killed 750,000 jobs last year and didn't do a damn thing for the economy.
Yeah, actually, that was probably my favorite point in your article, and it's something I have to be honest. As much as I'm, you know, I'm engrossed in politics, engrossed in these type of policy discussions, and yet that didn't even occur to me that we are still continuing the sequester. We're still talking about implementing more or how much we should implement, and that's way more job losses than possibly giving people a raise. How is that not out there more?
I think the bigger point though is that if you look at the best economic studies that have been done on the minimum wage, and ones that are sort of almost like laboratory tests, where you can look at what happens when, say, Washington State increases its minimum wage but Idaho doesn't. And so you've got sort of these rural Washington counties and these Idaho counties right next to each other, and you can look and study and see what actually happens when Washington raises its minimum wage and Idaho doesn't. And the net impact of studies like that is that there is no net impact. That, in fact, the indicators of economic activity tend to be higher on the Washington side of the border because people are flocking there for employment. And so, you know, and these are states where you would expect to see some differential, and if there was, you know, so what the CBO did, you know, critics say, is that they brought in a bunch of sort of lower quality data, sort of generic models, off-the-shelf research. They didn't do any of their own proprietary research on this. They just did a survey of the literature, and folks like the Harvard professor, who's basically made the critique that they seem to have not given due weight to what are like incredibly high value studies where you can actually document what's going on in a real world situation versus sort of standard economic modeling that has a lot more variability built into it.
Yeah.
So I think there's very good data that suggests that the net impact of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 on jobs would be nothing or close to nothing. And there are even some data that would show that it is positive. But even at the outside edges of what we're talking about here, the trade-offs are certainly within the acceptable margin and would seem to be, you know, I think that minimum wage advocates do themselves a disfavor by not even, you know, because even if you concede the worst case scenario of the CBO report, it seems like smart policy. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we're not talking about destroying jobs. We're talking about growing the economy, growing jobs at a slightly slower pace, and these are terrible jobs that don't pay the bills to begin with versus actually good jobs, you know, improving the lives of millions and millions of people.
Right.
Who, you know, because it's not just the minimum wage worker who gets a raise that benefits from this, but it's people up and down that lowest 20% of the income ladder whose paychecks are also adjusted.
And at some point,
because it really is sort of a tide that raises all those ships.
At some point, you just have to realize that it's the right thing to do when people need a living wage. It's the right thing for our economy, and it's the right thing for low-wage workers. Tim, thank you so much. This is a great piece. I could have spoken to you all day about it.
pleasure, Ruth. Thank you.
Tim Dickinson, contributing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, rollingstone.com. Check this out. There's lots of information.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's called Hey Washington, the Pay is Too Damn Low, the Minimum Wage War. Lots of good stuff in there. Welcome back, everybody, to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano sitting in, doing our best to fill in for Tom today.
It's different trying to push the buttons and call us at the same
You're
time.
You're doing a fine
I
job.
I pushed
Shane.
The wrong button and it just went clip.
You are doing an amazing job.
As are you. And the guests are amazing, and we have the phone calls coming in. I wanted to say something about the minimum wage there.
Okay.
Last time, Tim mentioned that we haven't raised the minimum wage here since 2007. And I don't know if probably Tom's listeners remember, but that was attached to Iraq war funding. The only way that Democrats could get it through was when George Bush wanted more. He wanted another emergency supplemental. And the Democrats, who had just taken over the House and the Senate in 2006 elections, said, we're going to put the minimum wage on here. So let's say there was some kind of international crisis going on. I don't know. And they wanted to push something through Congress coming up. I think it might be worthwhile for the Democrats to attach, you know, the veterans bill, which we were going to be talking to Justin Duckham about. You know, Republicans had no problem putting Iran onto that. So
if anything
big were to come up in the next couple of weeks or something, I would say the minimum wage should be attached to
it. You know, I just get so frustrated because here we are talking about 10-10 an hour, as if 10-10 an hour is charity to people who are working 40 hours a week and just want to be able to support themselves.
Right.
You know, there's such great
stuff. Or not have
stuff.
To be subsidized by the social safety net, where you have the Walmart and the McDonald's.
Which are actually subsidies for corporations.
Right, right.
You know, these are all great points that I didn't get a chance to ask Tim about, but that he goes through in his article. A lot of the stuff that Tom has talked about and explained as well as he does, Tim lays it out so well here about how wages haven't kept up since 1968 and that we need to do more. And, you know, 10-10 an hour, we're not asking that much.
Right.
That, you know, anyhow, that's my rant for the moment. We do have some callers on the board who have been waiting a while, so I wanted to get to Jenny in American Falls, Idaho. Jenny, thanks for calling and for watching Free Speech TV. You had a nomination for worst governor?
I sure do. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, and you're very welcome. Who do you think is the worst?
Well, my governor here in Idaho, his name is C.L. Butch. They call him Butch Otter, and he's running for a third term. I'd like to list the things that I think he's done that or hasn't done.
Okay, as long as that's the short list so we can make time for other callers here, but go ahead.
Sure. First of all, he refused the Medicaid for indigents that's offered by the Affordable Care Act. Secondly, he's being investigated for illegally awarding contracts for the school system. Thirdly, he just passed legislation in Idaho here just yesterday. I guess he signed the legislation for punishing reporters who exposed the physical and sexual abuse of dairy cows. Fourth, he allows submarine nuclear waste to be dumped in Idaho, while Idaho has the highest brain cancer in the nation.
Wow.
In northern... Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Jenny, it seems like you could probably go on for a while, and I think that puts Idaho's governor at the top of our temporary list here.
And that's just by doing things that Republicans do.
Yeah. And, you know, hey, it could be, this could be a bipartisan list.
It could be. I haven't heard him yet.
Yeah. But, Jenny, I apologize. I just want to make time for other callers. We don't have too many free segments here today. So I'm going
to. I just wanted to say that's only about half my list.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You can always post that over at tomhartman.com.
Absolutely.
And join the message board over there. There's a lot of great folks that I'm sure could commiserate and give you some hopeful points to talk about. What about Paul in Lucerne, California? Paul, you had some thoughts about Henry Wallace?
Yeah. In 1944, on April 9th, he wrote an article about American fascism at the request of New York Times. And I first heard about the article on Tom Hartman, and I read it, and he kind of explains American fascism to the T.
Okay.
He really does, and that's the problem with America right now, is we're in fascism. We're a fascist state right now. And if you have any questions, well, look at the NSA, all right? TransCanada trying to do this pipeline, all right? Protesters are going to protest it, and TransCanada, a foreign corporation, comes and briefs our police department about who the protesters are and what they're going to look like and their names and their phone numbers and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like there's way too much corporate power on so many levels in our country. Security, our prison systems, our schools, the list can go on and on. And while the right, while libertarians, and while, you know, some people even on the left cry socialism or cry other isms, I think you are a lot closer to the mark there, Paul. Thanks so much for calling and for watching Free Speech TV. Bia in Mount Vernon, Maine, you had some comments on Governor Paula Page?
Yes, there's a reason we call him La Plague in Maine.
Is that kind of like K6?
He's embarrassed us on numerous occasions, and yeah, this is really pretty bad. I just wanted to mention, in case people aren't aware, of how he got elected, and that was because he was the only candidate on the right, and the left was split between Libby Mitchell, the Democrat, and Elliot Cutler, who was again running ads everywhere on all the liberal sites I see. But anyway, what happened was LePage got in because the two other factions basically canceled each other out, and it's another object lesson in our dysfunctional voting system where it's a winner-take-all system. And if we had had something like IRV, which I have been trying to advocate for years.
Instant runoff voting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have, actually, I've worked out a system that's much more simple and direct than most of the ones I've seen where the complaint is that it's too complicated.
Bia, unfortunately, we are just flat out of time, but I am also a big supporter of instant runoff voting. I think that's the best way we're going to get some good, strong third parties and get parties like the Green Party powerful enough to stand a chance and start pushing the Democrats back left again. It's something we really need to do. We're going to be speaking with Ian Millhiser next. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Ian asks, is Clarence Thomas the most dangerous man in America? He's going to answer that next. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, and Shano is here with me, filling in for Tom today. If you listen to this show on average, you hear quite a bit about Supreme Court, and quite a bit of coverage about the cases and the justices In fact, Shano.
And the overwhelming power that they have.
Yes. In fact, you often hear Shano talking about those cases. And you may also read one of the finest justice blogs.
I think the finest.
Yes, perhaps the finest. Over at Think Progress, joining us now is Ian Millhiser, the senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and the justice editor for Think Progress. Ian, thank you so much for joining us. We are very excited to speak with you as always.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
You wrote a recent piece, Beware, Clarence Thomas is one of America's top legal minds. Are you telling me that he doesn't just rubber stamp everything that Justice Scalia says?
You know, I wish he did, because Scalia is actually a lot more sane than Justice Thomas is.
That's saying something.
I mean, Thomas is the leading proponent in the country of a view that was dominant in the early 20th century and has since fallen very much out of favor, that says that child labor laws are unconstitutional, that says that the minimum wage is unconstitutional, that says that things like the ban on whites-only lunch counters is unconstitutional. And that doesn't make him dumb. That makes him dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think that he's someone that we need to take seriously as a very powerful, very intelligent, and very dangerous individual who wants to do some, really quite frightening things to the Constitution.
Now, he considers himself, or if I'm reading your article and understanding correctly, a so-called originalist. I think some people would also refer to it as a strict constitutionalist. Why do you say that that's so dangerous, and why don't most people seem to recognize how powerful and dangerous Clarence Thomas really is?
Sure. So, I mean, like, if you ask me about originalism, originalism is the notion that we should interpret the Constitution the same way it would have been understood on the day it was written. And there isn't necessarily anything inherently wrong about that idea. You know, Justice Hugo Black was a very liberal justice from the 20th century who also believed the same thing, and he used originalism to achieve fairly liberal ends for most of his career. The problem is that when you try to go back and look at what how the framers would have read the Constitution, a lot of the times it's not clear. A lot of the times there's a lot of possible interpretations that are acceptable in the framers' view. And what Thomas has done for the most part is looked at the options that he has in terms of what Madison believed or how, you know, Thomas Jefferson might have read the Constitution, how people might have read it in the framing, and have said, I'm going to pick the one that's most conservative, fairly consistently over and over again. And like I said, his reading is a vision that leads to there not being any federal child labor laws. It leads to there not being a federal ban on whites-only lunch counters. And I don't think that's an America that too many people want to live in.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, how is it that somebody like Clarence Thomas, and I think that there are several members of Congress that also fall in this category, but how do they claim to know what the founders really intended? As you said, there are so many quote-unquote founding fathers, and there are so many Federalist Papers, so many papers to go back and reference. What gives them some authority to say that one is supreme over the other?
And to that matter, the founders didn't think that. You know, the big constitutional fight at the beginning of the Republic was a fight between Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson over whether the federal government could charter a bank. Madison said, no, they can't charter a bank. And 20 years later, Madison lost that fight. George Washington signed the bank bill. And 20 years later, Madison was president of the United States, and the issue came up again. They wanted to recharter a new bank. And Madison said, you know what? I lost that fight. You know, we have to accept the fact that history happens, that there have to be settled expectations in this country. And so James Madison had the wisdom to say, I'm not going to refight a battle that's already been fought and that I lost. The problem that I think you have with Thomas and a lot of these members of Congress who, you know, like Rand Paul saying that the Civil Rights Act is unconstitutional, is they're not willing to accept the fact that they lost. And they're not willing to accept the fact that a lot of people in this country have built their lives based on expectations about what the law would be. And if we suddenly sweep that all away, it would be hugely disruptive to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Ian Millhiser, the Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst at the Center for American Progress. You can check out this great justice blog at thinkprogress.org. What is your opinion on people who say that the Constitution was really intended to kind of evolve or change with us? And, you know, you bring up civil rights or the end of slavery, things that the vast majority of people came together and decided as a nation that we wanted to change. Was the Constitution intended to change with us, or, as Clarence Thomas seems to believe, was it just supposed to be a strict document meant to be interpreted 200 years later in the exact way it was written?
I mean, I don't think you necessarily even need to get into that fight. I mean, a lot of the times people like Thomas are just wrong about how the document was originally understood. I mean, the Constitution says that Congress has the right to regulate commerce. Now, that one example of a commercial market is the market for health care. So the idea that the Affordable Care Act is somehow unconstitutional is ridiculous. You just, you know, you can't read the Constitution that way in 1787. You can't read it that way now. The Constitution says, the 14th Amendment says, that no person shall be denied the equal protection of the law. Well, the last time I checked, gay people are people. So, you know, you don't really need to get into this fight over whether the meaning of the Constitution has changed to recognize that the big battles we're having right now, whether we can have an Affordable Care Act, whether marriage equality is something that we need to have in this country, you don't have to, you know, believe in an evolving Constitution to understand where those battles should fall out. You know, in many cases, the words of the Constitution are clear and the history of the Constitution is clear. And even when it's not, there's very clear principles written into the Constitution, and it's up to the justices of the Supreme Court to honor those principles, even if, you know, like some of the conservatives on the court, they may not like them very much.
Yes. And we know how some of the conservatives on the court feel about many issues that we're dealing with these days. There are so many important cases this term, as there always are, but there's so many that the media are paying attention to. How could Thomas affect some of these cases if this originalist argument actually pushes justices like Scalia or Alito? Could he have a big effect?
I mean, certainly if, you know, there were five votes on the court to implement his whole vision, you would see much of the 20th century repealed overnight. You
Wow.
know, all of the business regulation we depend on, all the workplace regulation that we depend on, much of the civil rights legislation we depend on would just be wiped out. I don't think there's five votes to do that now. I don't even know if there's two votes to do that right now. Thomas is a real outlier on this court. But in the short term, he's managed to, you know, his views on campaign finance have largely been adopted by the court, although he would push things even further than the court when Citizens United. He was the first justice to call for a very expansive reading of the Second Amendment. And then fairly recently, there were five votes to say that there is indeed an individual right and that handguns are super protected and no, we can't touch them anymore. So, like, Thomas has had an impact. And if we see more conservative presidents in the White House putting in more conservative justices in the future, you could see a majority around his view. And, you know, then we're living in a very different country than the one we live in right now.
Now, the Supreme Court is, you know, as Tom often calls them, the kings and queens of our country, and they are so powerful. How could Americans stand up to a situation like this? I mean, how do we get Clarence Thomas out of office, or how do we influence who the next Supreme Court nomination is?
Well, I mean, the answer is we don't get him out of office. You know, unless he commits a crime that he can be impeached for, he's in there for the rest of his life. But what we can do is we can make sure that we have presidents who will appoint the justices that we want, that we have senators who will confirm the justices that we want, and we can pressure them to make sure that they take this issue seriously. You know, one thing that I worry about this president is that, you know, I think that Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, who are the two people he's appointed to the Supreme Court, have done a good job, but he hasn't done, President Obama hasn't done a very good job of building a backbench. You know, President Clinton had to put Sotomayor on the lower court so that 10, 15 years later, she'd be there waiting for another president to elevate her. And there's a few of Obama's nominees and a few of the nominees who've been confirmed that are very, very good. You know, Nina Pollard on the D.C. Circuit is one of the most prominent women's rights attorneys in the country. I'd love to see her become a Supreme Court justice someday. But people like Judge Pollard are the exception, and that's a problem. People like President Obama need to realize that there's going to be a fight in the future, and we need to make sure that there's more Justice Sotomayor's waiting in the wing.
Well, hopefully with the semi-recent change in filibuster procedure, we'll be able to actually get some more federal judges appointed. Ian, you always do amazing coverage on this. You are one of my favorite people to talk to. I can't thank you enough for explaining this all to me and keeping me informed about the Supreme Court and everything else legal.
Thanks so much.
Ian Millhiser, everybody, senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, also the justice editor for Think Progress. Check it out at thinkprogress.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with Bob May of the Talk Radio News Service. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano here filling in for Tom. And as usual, Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service and the author of Sideswiped. Bob, thanks so much for joining us, and what's going on in the news today?
Well, thank you for having me. On the domestic front, the president has introduced a budget. He was trying to make some kind of appeal towards Republicans. That obviously was dead on arrival, but I did want to mention that the president has started that process. The Senate's really not going to consider a budget. I think they're just going to wait and see what happens through the House. The real top news, of course, is the Ukraine, and that really is dominating Washington as we speak. There's an aid package the president's asked for, which is $1 billion. Secretary of State Kerry was in Kiev reassuring the new government that, you know, we're going to be supporting them. But the talk of sanctions up on Capitol Hill against Russia really is going to ring hollow, because We're down below 10th in the trading partner. The European Union has the real power when it comes to the trade with Russia, and they're not talking sanctions at this point in time. So any talk of sanctions is more, I don't know, a saber rattling, I guess you could say, by us. Now, they have went into the blame game, saying John McCain, you know, well, if President Obama, you know, was stronger, and then, of course, John McCain's talking about if we had more military, which translates into John McCain wanting more money for the military, to spend through the Pentagon. And frankly, if we had 1,000 more nuclear weapons, that would not have stopped Putin.
Right. And I think it's pretty interesting that John McCain's saying something like that, or any member of the Republican Party, considering that they just voted down a bill that would support the troops that just got back from the last two wars. Yeah. It seems a little bit hypocritical. I know Tom has a lot to say on Ukraine, so I'm going to leave that one to him. But, to call for more war or more military when you're not supporting the military that you have is interesting, to say the least.
Well, it's also very hypocritical, too, because, look, President Bush said he looked into the eyes of Putin. He saw his soul.
Yeah, that's right.
He was pro-Putin. Georgia was invaded during Bush's time. So I think really for the benefit of the United States and our position on the world stage, it would be better if the members were less hypocritical on this and try to actually find some way that they can be of support to the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, but absolutely.
The one thing I did want to mention, now this is something in these days where, you know, as the two parties may not agree on much, they may agree about an Internal Revenue Service rule, because the IRS is looking at a rule, and it's concerned with nonprofits. And there are about 145,000 comments, and that was as the close of last week, on this new rule. And the IRS is saying that basically they're going to change the way nonprofit groups can focus on their issues, and 60 days before a general election, if the people running the ads clearly identify anything to do with a party or a candidate, then they would could lose their status. And so I think it's interesting because a lot of groups are maybe going to be put in jeopardy simply for mentioning, you know, a person's name, like to call your member of Congress when it comes to a health care bill or something.
Haven't they already figured out that game? Like Karl Rove and Crossroads figured out that game during the last elections by just calling everything issue ads. Regardless of what it was, they called it an issue ad, and they didn't have to mention a specific candidate because the stance they took on a particular issue was pretty clear on who they were supporting or who they were against. I mean, why not just interpret that IRS rule on 501c3s the way it was originally written to not have any political affiliation?
That's correct. And that would actually, you know, be the way to do it. But they've created some new rule, and I think probably it's going to be very, very controversial. And the one other thing I wanted to mention is that, and it's a setback for British Petroleum, and it deals with the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday rejected the company's efforts. They were trying to halt payments to the claimants. BP was trying to do that. They argued in court, and they had newspaper ads that the settlement was misinterpreted, and they were being forced to pay for damage unrelated to the incident. But this wording was very, very strong by Judge Leslie Southwick, and she ruled that the company was bound by the agreement it signed, because it did sign it, and they initially estimated costs to run $7.8 billion, and the companies put that figure at $9.2 billion. But you know what? That's what they cost with this oil spill. So I think for the people, it was a pretty good decision.
Yeah, I'm very happy to hear that. I'm a Florida native, so it was an issue that was always close at heart for me. And I don't think anybody out there is going to be crying any tears for BP if they have to spend a little bit more of their profits cleaning up their own mess.
That's correct.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We really, really appreciate it. Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service and Sideswiped, the book, Goats for the Old Goat. Of course, Ellen is over there in South Sudan right now. Is she not, Bob?
Oh, she is. She's over there in a troubled area of the world. It doesn't stop Ellen Ratner.
No, nothing stops Ellen Ratner. Nothing and no one if she has her mindset. Great talking to you. Thank you so much, Bob.
You too.
Do we have time for another phone call, Shane?
We have about a minute.
We have about a minute. Okay, yeah. So we won't...
in fact, Ellen actually came in the middle of the show. I think it was Thursday or Friday.
Oh, that's right.
You remember? And she, in the middle of Tom actually doing the talk radio news, segment, went, bye, and just gone.
Yes. Ellen Ratner, that is the hardest woman, the hardest working woman I have ever met.
Yeah.
Interesting that Obama put out a budget and the Senate isn't going to do anything. I'm very curious to go take a look at that and see if chain CPI is in there, as they said it wouldn't be.
They said it would not be, and they're out whining about it.
Yeah, I don't understand how he's trying to appeal to Republicans without putting...
You can't appeal to them.
Yeah, I know.
And you think he's finally figured that out. Let's hope.
Let's hope. Lots more in store. Going to be talking about voting rights. Just in time for the midterm elections, David Hayes, managing attorney of the Cochran firm, is going to be coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano are here filling in for Tom today. And one of the issues that I think is most important to everything else we talk about is our right to vote and our right to cast our voice and participate in democracy. And it is one of the things that has been most under attack recently. David Haynes, the managing attorney of the Cochran firm, cochranfirm.com, is here to tell us about these suppressive voting laws. And are they just in time for the midterm elections? Thanks so much for joining us, Dave.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. They do seem like they're just in time, doesn't it? This is a gift, really, I think, to the Republican Party. Unfortunately, this Supreme Court decision of Shelby County versus Holder, which came down last year, and as a result, we see many, many states trying to roll back a lot of the progress that's been made in the voting rights arena and really rolling back 30, 40 years or more of progress in this area. And the Justice Department has made in getting the feds essentially out of these state elections, and it's going to have serious, serious consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Just in 2013, 92 restrictive bills were introduced in 33 states. 13 bills were still pending at the end of last year, and 8 states had passed 9 different laws, I think, the worst being North Carolina and Texas, where Eric Holder either sued or took part in a lawsuit that was already under attack. Is this a coordinated effort by Republicans to minimize Democratic votes, or is this perhaps just what they really believe?
Well, you have to believe that there is, of course, a political motivation behind this. There's no doubt that any restrictions and any hurdles that can be put up to the right to vote benefits the Republican Party. Let's not be naive that there's not a national strategy here, as there are in many of these other issues, and then a number of the corporate interests are behind this as well. You see a lot of similar legislation that's being drafted out of certain think tanks and by certain donors, and then being introduced in whatever states they can get them in through. So do they believe that? Well, some do seem to believe that not everyone's voice should be heard, and that some people are more qualified to vote than others. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, absolutely. This being an election year, and all of these laws that were recently passed and more pending, more being introduced all the time, Eric Holder has filed suit against the state of North Carolina. He has joined the case in Texas. Are there other states that he should be looking at and be standing up for people's right to cast a vote?
Absolutely, and there are about 10 private lawsuit actions which have been brought around the country, basically attempting to enforce what's considered the bail-in provision, which is a little different than what's the sort of enforcement that we had before, where states were required to pre-clear any voting rights legislation, especially states where there's been historical discrimination. So absolutely, we need the Justice Department looking at these cases. There are a number of other states. North Carolina and Texas, as you've identified, are two of the most egregious states, but this is happening throughout the country in a number of areas. And of course, the pretext here is, oh, there's so much voter fraud, we're trying to prevent this, and many believe that essentially they're creating a problem to come up with their own solution, which they want to put forward anyway.
Yeah, before Shelby v. Holder and the Supreme Court struck down that formula to determine preclearance, the Voting Rights Act would have protected against a lot of this stuff. We just referred to bail-in, and I just wanted to back up for a second to give you a chance. Perhaps you could explain bail-in to the audience a little bit better than I could.
Well, yeah, the bail-in provision will allow federal courts to impose a preclearance if a state or local jurisdiction violates the Constitution's 14th or 15th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection and the right to vote. So this hinges on a slightly different part of the Voting Rights Act. So preclearance is not required, and the bail-in is being used as the new tool potentially for Voting Rights Act groups to try to eliminate some of this legislation which is being put in place post the Shelby decision. And it's certainly not as sweeping a remedy or as effective as what we had before with the Justice Department enforcement, but it is the next best thing, and these cases are moving through the courts, and hopefully we can get some enforcement that way. We'd like to see, you know, legislative fix through Congress, but we're certainly not optimistic there.
Yeah, I certainly agree. You being an attorney, perhaps you could answer this question. We're already in March. Is there enough time, say Holder was to bring a case against some of these other states, is there enough time that something could be done about these restrictive laws? Are we already at the point where we may not be able to fight them?
Well, I believe that there is certainly enough time. Time is always of the essence. Traditionally, litigation is a very slow-moving process, but I will say that the courts have been traditionally have taken these matters very seriously because of the sanctity of the right to vote, understanding the importance of the election law, the need to print ballots in time, and a lot of logistics that are required by the registrars. So I do believe that the courts, if they believe these are valid challenges, will take them up in appropriate time, and that there is still time for the Justice Department to have a real difference in the fall elections.
And is there any chance that Congress would restore the Voting Rights Act and pass a new formula? I know it's unlikely, but we've seen Sensenbrenner and others come out with a new version. Any chance at all that could become a reality?
Well, I think a lot of folks, you have to remain optimistic, and you have to keep fighting that good fight. I think if we were laying odds, it seems unlikely. The argument being that, you know, essentially, there is no discrimination anymore in these states. But if you look at, of course, what's these new hurdles that are being put up as a result of these state laws, they directly discriminate against minorities and the poor. And there's just no question that this is related back to, you know, the civil rights era. And we thought we'd made a lot of progress in this area. So if you're working a minimum wage job, are you as likely as a salaried person and a higher ranked white collar person to be able to take the time to stand in line? Do we want to encourage all voices to be heard and everyone to be able to vote? Why are the Republicans against early voting? Why are they against same day registration? Why are they putting up all of these, two forms of voter IDs? We know all these things target certain populations, and we'd like to think that there could be a fix in Congress, but I think it appears very unlikely.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that their claim of voter fraud is completely nonsense. So it only leaves one logical conclusion as to why they could be pursuing this type of legislation. Just real quickly, we only have a minute or so left, but what do you think legally? Like, Texas recently came out saying that they're not passing these laws on racial reasons, but they flat out admitted that they want to pass them to keep Democrats away from the polls. Right now, that's not protected under the Voting Rights Act. How do you think a court would look at that?
Well, a court needs to look at the demographics and what the disparate impact is on certain groups. And, of course, the Democratic Party has more support among minority groups and the working class. And so to say, you know, an admission that they are trying to keep Democrats out versus Republicans, I think, is potentially damaging. The court is going to need to look at the statistics, and hopefully that they will, and that the case can be made that this is having an impact on particular groups and particularly racial groups. And that's certainly been the history of these type of poll tax laws have been put in place. And so hopefully we can continue to move forward instead of going back, as we've done here in the last 6 months.
Yep, it is so very important. David, thank you so much for talking to us and breaking down a little bit of this technical stuff about the Voting Rights Act.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Haynes, managing attorney of the Cochran Firm, cochranfirm.com, and more coming up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Justin Duckham of the Talk Radio News Service is going to tell us a little bit more about that veterans bill last week. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano here, trying our best to fill in for Tom. And joining us now is Justin Duckham, the Chief Washington Correspondent for the Talk Radio News Service. You could check it out at talkradionews.com, and you can follow Justin on Twitter at jduckham. And Justin joins us every week for our show, Talking Left, and always brings great commentary, so we wanted to talk to him here. Justin, my first question, because I didn't get a chance to talk to you about this over the weekend. Last week, Bernie Sanders introduced a veterans bill that could have made life a lot better for current and former military. What the heck happened?
Well, that's a very good question. And going back on your original point, this really would have been a very big boon for veterans. This was a $21 billion bill over 10 years. This had over 140 provisions. This is something that would have expanded access to health care for our veterans. This is something that would have improved educational programs. For example, veterans who are, after serving overseas and coming back, they would have been able to receive in-state tuition for any school in any state under this bill. This was something that was not controversial at all. This is something that really reflected Congress's sort of nonstop sort of talking points for the troops. And as a result, it seemed to be pretty popular. It seemed to be moving en route, but then was suddenly stalled after Republicans decided to filibuster it on a number of grounds. The most popular one that we've seen was the provision, was the amendment, rather, that Republicans were pushing in order to add on language that would have levied sanctions against Iran, which is something that Democrats have been opposed to in recent weeks, as well as something that the administration has warned could, in fact, derail ongoing negotiations with Iran right now. This is something that Republicans tried to put on the defense bill for 2013 a little while back. It was something that failed, and it looks like their new tactic is to put this on more popular bills as it moves forward until they finally get a up or down vote on it, which is something that has been stated would be not just politically bad for Democrats, but would also endanger the administration's, very real chance at getting successful negotiations with
very
Iran.
Very real progress in diplomatic efforts. I think it's really interesting that the Republicans here essentially voted saying that they wouldn't support the troops unless they were allowed to possibly cause another war. I mean, that's how I read that vote. Really just doesn't make any sense for any party, for any American politician, to not support the men and women that fought for our country, regardless, even to those who may disagree with the war. These are still men and women who gave their lives to our country. And you had thoughts this week about John Boehner and his future as Speaker?
Well, he is a favorite hobby horse of mine, if you listen to Talking Left with Danielle and Shano, to give you guys a quick little plug. But yes, it looks like as of yesterday, he has announced to his local constituents that he is, in fact, going to try to run for Speaker again, which sort of raises a little bit of eyebrows, since no one is exactly sure why he would want to continue to serve in that role. He has obviously not been the most successful Speaker when you look at his scant legislative achievements. It looks like he is, going back in the ring for another swing. And this raises some very serious questions. It's already been pretty much widely accepted that we're not going to see immigration reform, nor are we going to see a vote on raising the minimum wage if we fail to have the Democrats' discharge petition move forward. And it looks like this is just going to make it a little bit harder, since now we're going to be seeing Boehner moving forward with his own political future in mind.
You say political future in mind, but I mean, with the split among Republicans, these Tea Party people and, former moderate conservatives, is this even possible? Could he get reelected as Speaker? And why the heck would he want to? I mean, political future, where's the political future of just constantly getting beat up by your own party?
That's a very good question. And I really think when we look at it historically, John Boehner is going to be a pretty interesting person to, judge speakership wise. You know, if anything, you know, I think at the end of the day, his tombstone may read, "He did the bare minimum to keep the U.S. operating," which is not the you know, best sort of thing to have as a lifetime achievement. But you know, on the other hand, as you mentioned, who would really vote for Boehner within the caucus? You know, there is of course a lot of Tea Partiers who are against him, and that raises some interesting questions. But it also raises who really would be the likely challenger. We know that the Tea Party is incredibly fickle. We know at a certain point in time they initially wanted Cantor to step in, the House Majority Leader, and eventually he was proven to be too, you know, I guess wishy-washy for the diehard conservatives in the House. So it doesn't look like we have anybody really in the wings to take over for him on the Tea Party front.
You know, the Speaker of the House doesn't necessarily have to be a member of the House, correct?
That's true.
So
yeah.
Could it feasibly happen that enough members of the Tea Party get together to nominate, say, Ted Cruz as the Speaker of the House?
You know, that would be a delightful little daydream to have. You know, we know last time around there were a number of people who threw in some random oddball names.
Yes.
Newt Gingrich was one that I think was put forward by Louis Gohmert.
Alan West was
another name that was floated, even though at the time he was not a member of Congress. Yeah, I guess they could theoretically put forward Ted Cruz, but at this point, I think enough Republicans are frustrated with him that, you know, they don't want him mucking up another chamber.
Now, could it work out well for Democrats, similar to an election where, you know, that the Republicans can't get enough votes for Boehner or somebody else as a speaker, and that maybe Pelosi becomes speaker again?
You know, that would be something that would be pretty unprecedented in, you know, American history. I think if it really came down to the fact or to a situation where a Democrat could be elected speaker, I think we would see a lot of these sort of extreme Tea Party types suddenly start whistling in a different tune. But, you know, again, this is something that Boehner did not necessarily do well on last time. He did eventually score the votes, but he was damaged pretty bad in the process.
We will have to wait and see. Justin Duckham, everybody. Thank you very much, Justin.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Always fun to talk to you, Justin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano here filling in for Tom. And we've spoken a lot today about minimum wage and the fight for a living wage that people can survive on. Dean Baker, economist and co-founder of Center for Economic Policy and Research, is joining us now. You can check out their website at cepr.net. Dean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, thanks a lot for having me on.
Absolutely. You know, minimum wage right now, we're trying to just get $10.10 an hour, which to me seems a bit ridiculous. It's still way too low for people to survive on. How is this wage gap hurting our country, and how do we tackle this issue?
Well, there's a couple things. You know, if the minimum wage, people have talked about getting to $10.10, and that's roughly where the minimum wage was back in 68, adjusted for inflation. If the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity growth over that period, it'd be about $17 an hour today, which is really an incredible thing to think about. That'd be above almost half of the wages of women working in this country and about 40% of the men working in this country. We'd have a very, very different story if we had wages that high, which isn't to say people think I'm saying we could raise the minimum wage to $17 an hour. Well, certainly we couldn't, or certainly not anytime soon. There'd be serious disruptions and job loss. But the point is, we've had enormous downward shift in income distribution, and the minimum wage is part of that story. I don't mean to say by any means it's most of it, or certainly not all of it. The other part is, you know, we've had a huge amount. There have been big winners, and, you know, much of this, the big gainers, you know, doctors, lawyers, professionals, highly paid professionals are big winners. The Wall Street people are big winners, and, of course, corporate CEOs. So we've had this bifurcation of the income distribution where we've had a huge amount of money being shifted upwards, and much of the country falling, I shouldn't say much, most of the country falling way behind. And that just leads, you know, a less stable economy, and I think, you know, much less desirable economy, the country. This isn't the world most people want to live in.
Yeah, and then, you know, you think about how we fight to change these issues, and one of them obviously being voting rights. When somebody is struggling on working two or three jobs at minimum wage or below minimum wage, not only can they not get involved with voting, with participating in the political process, but they can't even watch these issues. They can't even pay attention. Doesn't that essentially destroy our whole democratic process?
Well, both sides of it. So it's obviously a struggle for people at the low end to stay involved. And the other side, of course, when you have, you know, billionaires who could drop, you know, $5 million, $10 million on a campaign, that makes a huge difference. And everyone in Washington knows this. I mean, it's not like I'm, you know, across the political spectrum. They laugh at you. You know, if you want to run for office, you know, for Congress, Senate, and you don't have millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars lined up, they laugh at you. They will literally laugh at you. Why should we talk to you? You're not going to win. Well, you're not going to get tens of millions of dollars if you want to run for a Senate seat here in Maryland, where I actually live in D.C., but, you know, nearby Maryland or Virginia. You're not, don't have a chance. And how are you going to get that money? You're going to go to the millionaires and billionaires and get them to give you big contributions. So it's incredibly corrupting. And again, everyone knows that. No one is going to try and tell you otherwise. No one's going to try and tell you you're going to win an election unless you have a lot of people who could drop, you know, 10,000, 20,000 in your campaign, and that's not your average worker.
Absolutely not. And it just shows how broken our system is. You know, right now it seems like we've almost got a new caste system where so many people are in this bottom rung of society in terms of income and pay, and so few in this upper echelon of people who separate themselves from the rest of us. How do we break that? How do we, you know, force them to wake up and recognize that the rest of us are human beings and we deserve the same rights that they have?
Well, there isn't an easy path. I mean, I think it's really unfortunate. You know, when we had the economic crisis back in 08, you know, basically both parties would rush to put together the pieces and, you know, keep Humpty Dumpty from cracking up. You know, Wall Street was on its back. And, you know, they basically, you know, rushed the transfusions, and we were supposed to be thankful. You know, Federal Reserve Board Chair Ben Bernanke, you know, of course, recently retired as chair last month, or I guess 2 months ago now, and they were celebrating the fact that he avoided a second Great Depression. You go, well, that's really kind of a low bar.
Yeah.
You know, oh, we didn't have a second Great Depression. Well, we didn't have a second Great Depression in the 1980s, the 1990s. Like, that's supposed to be, you know, wow, great success. You know, anyhow, the point was they created this horror story so that we were supposed to be happy that Bernanke, the Fed, the Treasury rescued Goldman Sachs, rescued Citigroup, rescued all these big Wall Street people, so that the people who brought this on the country and on themselves walked away richer than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then we're supposed to be happy about this. I was sort of struck. There was a piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago by the head of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank here in Washington. And he said, oh, the problem is people have envy. You know, they shouldn't have envy. You know, that's bad. You know, what the hell's the envy here? You guys are ripping us off. You're incompetent. You took all this money from us, and you're walking away. The people who wrecked their banks walk away with tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. This is their job. I mean, apart from, I'm not asking any moral question, if you're running a bank, you're not supposed to bankrupt it. That's pretty straightforward. So I'm not saying they're
yeah.
good people or, you know, they made good lines. I'm just saying, you know, did they do good by the bank? No, they put it in bankruptcy. But, you know, instead of, you know, the rest of us, we mess up on our jobs, we're out on the street. They walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't make any sense. I want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Dean Baker, Center for Economic Policy and Research, CEPR.net. How can people listening get involved and, you know, just show how angry they are about this system? I don't think it's enough sometimes to just show up on election day or just post something online. These are big issues. To fix our country, you know, we have to get involved, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to do different things. I mean, part of it is the media conveys a lot of this information to people. So the media certainly pushed the line that we were supposed to be thankful to Ben Bernanke. I started beating up just on Ben Bernanke because he's the worst of the people out there. But, you know, but they created this story that we should be very thankful we didn't have the second Great Depression. So even though, you know, we still have tens of millions of people out of work or underemployed, we still, you know, all the gains of growth, you know, since the downturn have gone to those at the very top. We're supposed to be thankful we didn't have the second Great Depression. Like, we should be sending them thank you notes. You know, well, talk to reporters, you know, send them emails, you know, tell them, you know, we have changed coverage on things. You know, it's something I do a lot of, you know, and that's important because that's what everyone understands. I'm not saying that people accept necessarily the second Great Depression story, although a lot do. But, you know, people, when people are confused, it's very hard for them to challenge things. A lot of people, you know, they're really worried about the budget deficit. And
yeah.
People should beat up on their reporters. And I don't mean physically beat them up if anyone's thinking that. No. Send them letters. Send them emails. Polite letters. Polite emails. It's not good reporting. The budget deficits were our friends. We have an economy where the private sector was not creating enough demand. The government has to fill the gap. It's not a question whether you like the government. You're welcome to hate it. But the reality was, if you wanted to have growth in jobs, we need government deficits. So we have all these politicians running around Washington patting themselves on the back for getting the deficits down. That's great. You cost us millions of jobs. Good work, fellas.
Yeah. So, I mean, I say it's time for another public works program. It's time to throw some banksters in jail, but that's my personal opinion. You know, people haven't seemed to wake up to the issues that are going on. Do you think if we had gone into some second great recession, as it's been called, do you think that would have been enough to get people really aware of the issues and have some banksters put behind bars?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, we approached this, meaning the government approached this with the idea they were going to do what was necessary to keep the Wall Street banks functioning. If they had collapsed, you know, in other words, if they hadn't done the bailouts and they had collapsed, my guess is a lot of these guys would have gone to jail. And just to be clear, it's not this, you know, people say, well, you want to send them to jail, you want to put people in jail. Well, they committed fraud. I don't know if these people's individuals committed fraud, but their banks committed fraud on a massive scale. The story here is fairly simple. They had a lot of mortgages, which everyone knew were junk. We have emails. They knew they were junk. They took them and threw them in mortgage-backed securities and sold them all over the world. Now, did the CEOs of those banks know that they were putting fraudulent mortgages in? They either knew or they should have known and deliberately did not know. And that doesn't protect you from fraud. If you had good reason for knowing that these were junk mortgages and you're passing them off as good mortgages and you didn't do anything to stop it, that's fraud. That's the sort of thing that gets you in jail.
Yeah. And if it was you or I and we'd committed fraud for, say, $1,000 against some business or individual, we would at the very least be dragged into court and questioned and investigated over it. Yet the bankers and Wall Street got bailed out and got billions, if not trillions, of dollars as a thank you gift.
Yeah, there's something to think about in context here. The Huffington Post has a piece about this young man who's going to jail in California for working in a place that sold marijuana, legal marijuana, it's medical marijuana. And I'm not familiar with the exact charges, but he's paid to work there, and he thought what he was doing was legal. And he's actually facing a prison sentence, I forget whether it's 6 months, a year, longer than anyone at Citigroup served, longer than anyone at Wells Fargo served.
Wow.
Really kind of mind-boggling. He was prosecuted by the feds, by the way, so that's why I'm not picking on, you know, some local police department, you know, with nuts. This was the feds. This was our Justice Department. They couldn't figure out how to prosecute anyone on Wall Street. They figured out how to prosecute this young man for being a clerk in a marijuana store.
That is astonishing on so many levels. Dean, thank you so much for joining us. Really an honor to speak with you, and I could sit here and talk to you all day.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker, everybody, economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. You can check it out at cepr.net.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Thank you very much to everybody who's been waiting on the phone, and we will get to your calls next. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano here, filling in for Tom today. Tom will be back next week, and lots of great, amazing people coming in to fill in. As promised, I wanted to get to your calls, and thank you to everybody who's been waiting. Some people a really long time, and we really, really appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hi, Paul. How's it going today?
Oh, pretty good. I wanted to talk about the minimum wage. First, about the Washington State minimum wage, which is at $9.32 an hour, the highest in the nation. A lot of people don't know this. It's not a bunch of liberal Washington State legislators, commo pinky communists, you know. this is the legislation we have here in the reason it's $9.32 an hour was passed in 1998 as a citizens' initiative. It's the will of the people.
Oh. Yeah.
And the thing I want to point out about this, $10.10 an hour, because the Washington State minimum wage is linked to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, it was $4.70 when in 1999 when the law first took effect. It was $4.70 an hour, so it's essentially doubled. And the way I calculate it, the increase because of the CPI, if it follows the same pattern, the Washington State minimum wage will be $10.10 an hour or thereabouts by the time the next president takes office.
Wow.
So
and
we will see.
Hey, has it cost lots of jobs there in Washington State?
Oh, you got to see, Washington State is falling apart. I mean, no, I think Seattle is the fourth most economically upward mobile city in the nation. So I don't see that it's in falling apart like, say, Michigan. And the other thing is, the counties in eastern Washington, your guest was mentioned that, yes, they will, the minimum wage will go up, but that also has a spillover effect and helps the northern counties in Idaho because people go across the border and spend money there. But
well,
I want to say something about the arguments that the Republicans put forward about, well, we'd have to lay people off. It costs jobs. Well, you know what that assumes? That presumes that the staffing at the lower level of the economy, they're overstaffed. They don't really need all these people. They're just giving them money because... So, listen, if you have four people on a burger shift, you can't say, well, we'll just lay somebody off and the burger guy will start waiting the front counter while the burgers are sizzling into, you know, charcoal.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, we know that many of their economic theories don't work out quite the way that they would like people to believe. But, Paul, I really appreciate it. I'm going to quickly jump to a couple other people here, get as many calls as we can in these last few minutes. Jacob Dean in Portland, Oregon. Hello, my friend.
Hey, guys, so good to hear you.
It is very good to hear you, too. Jacob Dean, of the host of Filter Free Radio, and also former Tom Hartman producer. Thanks for calling in, Jacob.
Guys, I just had to call in real quick and say you guys are doing a fantastic job. I love you guys, miss you guys. Shout out to you guys and Tom and Louise and Sean and everybody and Jim and Sue. All you guys, love you guys, miss you guys. And talking about the minimum wage here in Oregon, you know, we got the second highest at like $9.10 an hour. And I'm really excited about the movement going on up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, gravitating around $15 an hour. It's a great way to get people out there to get active, to participate, and to make a difference. And that's what it's all about. And that's what you guys are doing on the air. That's what folks are doing up there and here and all around. And it's a beautiful thing. And I won't take up any more time. I just had to give you guys a shout out and say I miss you guys, love you guys. And you guys are doing so great. It's so good to hear you guys. And I know you guys probably can't talk about it too much, but I can. And I say, Danielle and Shano host a fantastic online program. It's called Talking Left, and you should check it out.
Oh, well, thank you, Jacob. You've succeeded in making me blush on TV today. Jacob Dean, we love you, and everybody should tune into Filter Free Radio as well. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
All right, let's go to Jesse, watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Jesse, what's your thoughts on the minimum wage?
The best way I think to go about it is having a economical system that's compatible with democracy, and that would be a cooperative system.
Yeah.
A cooperative system.
Absolutely. Some of the co-ops that have opened up recently, great stories about them, very successful, and workers having a voice.
That's what we need, because capitalism and communism is incompatible. We're getting ready to go to war. Capitalism and communism. The last world war was capitalism and fascism.
Yep.
So the only way to avoid it is ignore the 99% have to have an alternative.
Yeah.
If we all just keep funding, going with the failed systems, we're going to have a failed political system. So we need an economical system that's compatible.
I certainly agree, and I think co-ops are a great suggestion. Jesse, thank you very much for hanging on with us and waiting so long. We have just enough time for one more call going to David in Ferndale, Washington. David, you think that the minimum wage should be $15 an hour? I have to agree with you.
Well, at least that. As Mr. Baker pointed out, it should be more like 17 if wages kept up with the increase of productivity and so on. I just wanted to point out that in Washington, and especially our good mayor in Seattle, they're trying for a $15. It should be an impetus for all people in all states to increase it. 10-10 is a bare minimum. I mean, that's the bare bones minimum.
Yeah.
And I would like to make one other quick point, and then I'll get off, and that there's lots of other people interested in talking. There was a food stamp bill, I believe, attached to the farm bill that was.
Yes.
I'm not clear on how they got rid of the food stamp part. Was it just was the whole bill failed, or did just that part of it fail?
Well, they separated them out, which was something that they hadn't done in decades. They put those two together.
Since the beginning of it.
Yeah, they put those two together so that Republicans would be forced to vote on the food stamp bill, and Democrats would be forced to vote for farm subsidies for corporate farmers, and that's called compromise. It actually got something done.
For a very long time,
yes,
until this term.
Until they broke it. Big thanks today to all of our amazing guests, Sean Taylor for putting the show together.
And Farron
Cousins, as well as Jim Javinsky and Pete Callahan for making the wheels turn there in the background. And, of course, thanks to Tom and Louise for letting us host the show, and thanks to you guys for listening. Another great guest host will be in tomorrow, so tune in.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.